This is the Lattice Training Podcast, where we bring you the best in climbing performance and training from the world's elite athletes, thought leaders, and coaches.
Hello, and welcome to the Lattice Training Podcast. Today, the hosts are me, Josh Hadley, and
myself, Johnny Kidd.
And we are interviewing Paul Huffy, who is one of the most respected physiotherapists in the UK, having worked with Sean Coxey at the Olympics, and also seeing probably pretty much every coach here at Lattice Training when we've had injuries.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of us have reached out to Paul for help when we've needed it.
Yeah. He's super knowledgeable when it comes to climbing, having climbed at high level and been in the game for a long time in physiotherapy. And I mean, in this podcast, we're also going to get into the fact that he's performed at high level in multiple sports, including competing at a national level in jiu-jitsu.
Yep.
And we're going to get an interesting story about how
he came to stop that.
How he came to stop jiu-jitsu. But, you know.
We'll leave no spoilers.
Okay, we'll leave that till later. You have to get into the podcast for that one. Yeah. Of course, we're also going to cover a lot about injury, including some injuries which you might not have heard before, which are commonly misdiagnosed as pulley injuries. So that's a really important topic to get into.
As well as also the prevalence of things like shoulder injuries and how we can look to work around those kind of issues going forward in our climbing, and what advice is good to look out for and what you might want to avoid as well.
Yeah. Also a little bit of chat about our climbing culture in general and social media. And we'll hear at the end some of his kind of ideas about where we should be moving in terms of social media. But generally, this is about advice and how it's presented and some of the things he thinks climbers should be doing if we want to just generally improve our performance on wall, which is cool. Yeah. Always like to get into training takes from people who aren't necessarily a coach, but obviously have a good knowledge of anatomy, performance, and that kind of thing. So stay tuned and we'll get into it.
Yep, hope you enjoy it.
I have a bit of a question leading into the physio aspect of your role in the climbing community now. Were you a climber first or a physio first?
Yeah, definitely a climber first. So climbed really since the age of around 13 or 14, when I realised that I didn't really like football or rugby, which is basically all you do in North Wales. Just sort of moved away from like the conventional sports, and I don't know, found a home in climbing, I suppose. It just felt quite natural. My family have all climbed. My grandfather's a bit of a dark horse climber, and my mum climbed, and it just seemed like a really obvious thing to do at the time.
Okay. And so when you decide you wanted to be a physio, after a number of injuries? Or?
Yeah, pretty much. I, to be honest, you know, I didn't really know what to do. I did a degree in musculoskeletal anatomy and zoology. So, it was a bit of a funny degree. I could literally choose any module I wanted. And then someone would go, yeah, they kind of make sense. And yeah, you can do all those. So like I was doing dissections, cadaver dissections. And then, you know, an hour later, I was learning about cuckoos. So I came out of university a little bit confused, knowing a little bit about quite a lot, but not really knowing what to do. So I just made skateboards for a couple of years, like became a shaper for Lush Longboards. That was quite a cool job. And then it just came down to teaching or physio, and it just so happened that the physio interviews came up first, and I got an unconditional offer for Sheffield, and that was that really. My second degree started then, and yeah, it was definitely a good move. It's been a really good career for me so far.
Yes, I know, and now you're also a physio to the GB team.
Yeah.
And to Sean Coxey as well in the past through the 2020 Olympics.
Yeah.
Actually, we'll get into that in a bit. But I want to jump in with a question which you highlighted to us a while back when you did a coach catch-up here at Lattice Training.
Oh, yeah.
And we spoke about a finger injury that because we hadn't really heard of, and you kind of mentioned this might be an injury that a lot of people have but maybe gets misdiagnosed. And this is the crimp finger.
Yeah.
So could you tell us a little bit about what crimp finger is and why it's not really diagnosed as such?
Yeah, so you can kind of be forgiven a little bit by the fact that it's been overlooked a little bit in the past, but essentially you've got your A4 pulley connecting just here in your middle phalanx, And just below it, you've got the tendon, which flexes the PIP joint. And for a long time, you know, the A4 has been overly associated with being the source of a problem. And what we've sort of discovered, I guess, because it's a relatively new sport and you're going to find these things, is that perhaps it's been overly demonized, when actually the source of the problem is actually the tendon, the contractile problem itself, with the A4 pulley actually being absolutely fine, not even being involved with the pain generation. So it's a really easy oversight to make, because when you press, the difference between being on a pulley and the tendon is probably about 2 or 3 mil. And so, yeah, you could easily be fooled into thinking it's an A4 problem.
So what's going on here? People are palpating, and by that I mean they're like pressing against the area which we'd associate with where the A4 pulley is, feeling pain, and maybe jumping to the conclusion that this is an A4 strain.
Exactly. And I think, you know, because the pulleys are so well understood and talked about, the same thing happens to the A2. So if you've got something like a trigger finger problem, and, you know, you've got like a little bump on that tendon that's catching between your A2 and your A1, a lot of climbers will feel pain when their fingers are flexed. But what's happening in that position is that tendon's tracked down to your A1 and it's getting compressed there. Then when you open your hand up, that little irritated bit of tendon's actually gliding up to sit right underneath your A2. So when you open your hand, you obviously assess your hand by straightening your fingers. You're actually pressing on a painful tendon. And the A2 is just a sort of symptom of that kind of collection of problems. So you'll say you've got an A2 problem. But for those people who this is, proves true, you'll find if they flex and you press around your A1, that painful bit will come into play as you flex the finger. You might even feel a bump running underneath your finger that's quite sore. So a lot of people assume it's an A2 partial tear or something, but it's not. It's actually the tendon itself. And the same proves true for the crimp finger. I've called it crimp finger because it seems to happen at higher flexion angles. So, yeah, it's the same sort of thing, a tendon problem, not a pulley.
So, yeah, so as you mentioned there, like, the prevalence is often when you're crimping, hence the name and whatnot. But is there any kind of differences that you've noticed with how it onsets? So obviously pulleys, very typical, have that like bang effect when they go, and they're quite aware. Does that differ with the crimp finger?
It does. So it can come on really slowly, or it can come on really suddenly, and that can be with or without trauma to the A4. The more common thing I do see is actually the slow build-up as people get onto progressively smaller edges. And that inevitably sees the DIP, the end of your finger, falling into a bit of hyperextension, and then the flexion angle of your PIP getting greater, which just goes to see that tendon becoming more and more active. There's risk factors for that. So if you're hypermobile, you're more likely to get that problem, because obviously if an edge size is smaller than the distal phalanx, you're going to put more and more stress on your volar plate, that stretchy ligament which goes backwards. And anyone listening to this can just test and see how bendy that joint is. And the bendier that is, the more you're going to see overload through this guy, which sees your FDS slowly building up more load. And that's usually why they become a sort of a gradual chronic problem. And that's where you see people saying, well, I think it's probably your A4. It's sore in that spot. And then they say, well, I didn't hear a pop. And that's where sometimes people will go down, oh, it might be a partial tear. And it behaves very much like that, but actually it's a load tolerance issue in the tendon itself, and it usually takes a specific approach to see that load tolerance build up.
Okay, that's interesting with the hyperextension of that distal joint on the finger.
Yeah,
because I have extended a lot. I remember you just said like you get a bit of hyperextension. I was like, I think I get a lot of hyperextension.
I get quite a lot as well.
Yeah. Do you see this occurring more in people with these sort of hypermobile distal joints in their fingers?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. There's a much higher incidence of it in hypermobile people. Same for TFCC problems. You see more TFCC problems in people who are hypermobile, and that's usually when their hand goes from really engaged, so there's loads of good muscle tension through their flexor tendons and forearm muscles, and the more open they get to, so it's the opposite crimp finger, the more they fall onto a straight wrist, and that's where you see, tend to see traction problems and twisting problems in more vulnerable connective tissue. Once that kind of seatbelt of tension's gone in that crimp position. So unfortunately, you know, whether you're high angle crimping or open handed, being hypermobile does sort of predispose you slightly more to more of these sort of issues.
Can you explain where the TFCC is and where that pain might be felt?
Yeah, so the TFCC is triangular fibular cartilage complex. And basically, I've gone to lots of presentations with consultants on this, and some consultants seem to think it's a bit of a mystery, and others seem very, very sure that it's a very easy, straightforward thing to treat. The TFCC is essentially a complex of cartilage and ligaments that sit between your ulna, so your pinky side forearm bone, and the bottom of that pinky side hand. And because your radius is longer than your ulna, this complex sits there to make up that distance and provide some stability to that mobile part of your wrist, which has got a lot more mobility in it than the radial side.
Okay, I mean, the burning question for a lot of people with this sat at home with wrist pain is, if I've got this, what should I do?
That's an interesting one, because TFCC problems can arise because of, you know, natural variance in how long that ulna is. That's called a positive ulna variance. So if your ulna is slightly longer, you get what's called abutment, which means there's not enough breathing space in there for that complex of cartilage. And these guys are the ones that tend to have bilateral symptoms. They're the ones that you see with wrist widgets on both wrists, unable to do press-ups, dips, anything that puts their wrists into hyperextension. And that's just because when they push down, there's no breathing space and the TFCC gets crushed. So that's something that basically is quite hard to treat conservatively if you've got true positive ulna variants. And that's one where you need imaging to kind of confirm that. Those guys tend to basically go through the mill of getting lots of rehab exercises, never being able to press, and always having a recurrence of problems. And they're the minority. The majority of people, the majority of people tend to get more of the ligament cartilage problem, and management of that depends on how early you catch it. If you catch it early, you can splint those and they tend to settle. When it becomes more chronic, you're looking at management of that. And it really depends on the degree of instability. So how unstable, how torn is the cartilage, how unstable are the ligaments, and that'll sort of tell you where to go next with it.
Okay, cool. So there's not just a strengthen your wrists approach to that?
No. But typically they're much better in extension. And that goes, that's for the reason I've explained at the beginning. So, you know, it's ironic I say people who've got it really bad, they can't press on it, but that's a compression problem. Most of the time when we're actively extending, we're not taking that joint to end range. We're somewhere in the middle and you've got the maximum amount of muscles firing, which gives that approximation. It kind of gives you that stability. Saying that, those people with TFCC problems will usually struggle undercutting. So when you go full supination, that's generally quite uncomfortable as well. So yeah, it's about avoiding those positions, really keeping them in the happy place and seeing the thing settle over time. Or not, and then you've got to think what you do next with that.
Yeah, I wonder if that's why we see some people just like full crimping slopers. They start to open hand it.
Would you recommend for people in those kind of positions that they modify their body position when they're doing things like fingerboarding, for example, to try and create a better position for the wrist?
Yeah, it's really interesting. The position of your wrist, not just in extension, but also in rotation, has such an impact on the fingers. And we can talk about this maybe a bit later, but you know, the rotational control of your entire arm will really have a massive effect on how those fingers behave. And it's particularly important when you get people who've got chronic overload issues that you kind of consider that entire chain, which we've talked about on, you know, teaching sessions we've done together.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to jump into the next question then. And we kind of been talking about a misdiagnosed climbing injury. And that's a specific thing, but I want to know what's the most misunderstood concept or myth within physiotherapy and climbing rehab.
I mean, you could ask a lot of different people that question and get a different answer from them. I'd say that most is probably a bit ambitious to answer, but I would definitely say there's some trends that I see that perhaps need, you know, questioning a little. What one is the idea of TheraBands being the best way to take an injured shoulder all the way to the point where they're strong enough and ready to climb on. You know, if you look at the peak force of a band, it's around about 4 or 5 kilos, the TheraBands that people kind of stretch around, not the power bands. And when I look at sort of load cell testing, you'll see people generating sometimes over 30 kilos with their shoulder rotation. And so, you know, you if you're doing that and just using bands, you're going to chronically underload those shoulders, and it won't prepare you for climbing. And also it won't prehab the shoulder, so make it less likely to be injured.
I guess as well, like, it's not that hard to use small weights. And then you've got this very measurable effect without it being a large variance in terms of the force. Because obviously when you stretch a band to its extreme, it's going to be way more force than when it's at the beginning of it with motion as well.
Yeah. And if you think about that rule, when you're going to an inner range, you're getting more tension, which means you're never preparing a muscle to be strong in outer range when you're using a band. And that's where we use our muscles when we're climbing. And so it's actually not a great tool if you're trying to take, and it's particularly relevant to injured people or people you're trying to prehab, like I say, to stop them getting injured. You think about sort of the numbers that you're seeing in shoulders. A lot of people tend to, I think, well, for some people, I would say, rather than generalizing, there's this concept that if your elbow's pointing to the floor and you're rotating your arm, that's for your rotator cuff. And if your elbow's resting on your knee and you're doing that with a weight, that's for your deltoid, you know? But the truth is all the muscles are working together all the time. And the forces, like I say, they're in double digits, often, you know, around 30 kilos plus for a strong internal rotation, less for your external rotation. Normally like a 2-to-3 ratio is the kind of ratios I normally see. I've been testing these things for absolutely years, and that's the sort of ratio I sort of work towards, not really strictly, but I definitely like to kind of try and get around that ballpark.
I just want to quickly ask how you're measuring these forces with internal, and just in general, you measure like a maximum voluntary contraction, don't you? And you might do this on both sides.
Yeah. So over time, basically, I've gone from being learning in physio school, all these special tests and resisted tests just using my hand. And over time, I've ditched most of those things because when you actually look at the science behind them, they're not really very specific. And it would be quite easy to go A plus B equals C. But ultimately, when you've got a shoulder in front of you that's, you know, not working properly, you need to know what the horsepower is like in it. And it sort of moves away from specific diagnoses sometimes to, well, how strong is it in rolling in? How strong is it rolling out? And my approach is a lot about just looking at that arm moving, looking at what the shoulder blade's doing, observing all the muscle patterning and seeing what's going around that. Lots of feedback from the patient. And then going into load cell testing, which I'll modify for each person. If someone's in a lot of pain, I won't get them to stand and lift their arm against gravity, because it might be the case that whatever's causing the pain is actually knocking off their capacity to the point where they're under 2 kilos, which is, you know, the weight of an average arm, plus a couple if you're bigger. So, you know, if they're hitting like 1.5 kilos, it's kind of pointless making that muscle carry the arm against gravity and do a resisted test. You're going to get a lot more specific loading and feedback. You get that person lying on their back and with their arm supported and basically arm by their side. And that would be kind of, you know, step one for a very painful arm. And that would benchmark against the other side. And then I would just try and figure out how, as quickly as possible, we get those numbers up, considering the position of that shoulder, which is actually really important. But I can talk about that in a bit.
Do you feel like there's a stereotypical kind of like general number that you're going for in terms of balancing from the healthy side to the unhealthy side, where you're like, right, okay, we can kind of like return to play now almost?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. You can get a bit too hung up on perfection, left and right being the same. I think for me, as long as the sort of performance of that shoulder's good, I'll allow kind of a leeway of 10-20%. But beyond that, I generally tend to see some dysfunctions building in muscles that are as important as, you know, rotator cuff. most people who come in who don't have shoulder problems won't have a bigger difference than, say, 20% when you do sort of, you know, load cell testing in various positions.
Yeah, okay. Can you, I can't remember where I've seen this, and maybe it's from multiple sources, but I've seen people using like luggage weighers.
Yeah, that's...
To measure, really cheap, just off the internet, a few quid, you can get a little luggage weigh, which gives you...
The Newton.
It's probably not as accurate as a load cell, like a tin deck or something, but if you're just measuring a few kilos and you can probably see a difference between sides, I guess that's a...
That's right.
A nice way.
So I actually started using those years and years ago because they were as good as like the £1,000 FE2, which is like a little Bluetooth unit that you kind of push against someone, they push into you. And these luggage scales were as accurate in ranges you'd need, because most people's luggage aren't more than like 40 kilos. And I think these things max out at 50, your average kind of 10-pound luggage scales max out at 50 kilos. So they're pretty much good for testing everything in the upper limb. The only thing they can't really test is your quads, which usually kind of go over 50 kilos when you do like a middle range quad test. So yeah, they're amazing. And I will often kind of really try and explain that load issue to a patient and give them, you know, the tools themselves, show them testing positions, find an exercise or two that seems to improve that in the session, and get them to build on that and test themselves. And they love that because they become their own physios, and objectively they know they're getting somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know why I haven't actually bought one yet.
I'm fully expecting now to see that, like at the crag, people warming up with a luggage thing, fingerboard, like testing their fingers.
Well, they're very good for pain, because when pain's your only currency, you've got no idea if you're improving. It just hurts. And I actually really use numbers to try and help compliance. It's most important in things that are really painful, like a lumbar spine. If you've got a disc problem and say that's affected the strength in that leg, day to day, that person goes away and does, you know, their rehab, comes back and says it still feels the same, but objectively they've doubled the strength of that leg. And we know there's always going to be a bit of a delay between that strength improving and the pain going. You have to restore that strength for the back pain to settle. And again, that's really good for motivation. So when it comes to injury, that sort of testing is really good. But once you've got your function back, I think, you know, sometimes it's better to put the testing away, just go out and do the movement and enjoy the thing that you've basically not been able to do for ages, you know?
Because pain is a proper killer of motivation.
It is.
And I think so many people get too hung up on like, oh, it hurts, I shouldn't be using it.
Yeah.
When really that's pretty much the opposite of what they should be
doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough line to walk if you know you're in the dark with it. It is a hard line to walk with injury when you're in pain. And you know, that's why there are pain specialists who just talk about pain. And it's a squirrely thing when it's been there for a while. Pain, it tends to, you know, create other problems that then cascade and become quite hard to unpick. So yeah, some of my job isn't talking about numbers and exercises, it's talking about perceptions of the problem. And if you don't do that bit right, you sometimes all the kind of smart testing and clever ideas, they just don't mean anything. So yeah, you do need to get over that hurdle sometimes.
Yeah. My next question is, what is unhelpful physio advice that climbers should look out for?
Okay.
And I think I've got, as coaches, we've obviously worked with a lot of physios, and we've worked with a lot of climbers through injuries and getting back to full strength and climbing and stuff. So we've probably seen a bit of advice which maybe
we wouldn't give ourselves.
Yeah,
but I want your take on this first, and maybe we'll give our take on it as well.
Yeah, I'd like to hear your take on it, because I actually see quite a lot of conflict and things on social media, in particular, mainly between coaches, really hotly debating one approach versus another. And that does happen with climbers as well, or climbing physios. There's a lot of different ways to sort out injuries. But, you know, to answer this, it's probably good to preface that there's a truth in everyone's ideas if they're, you know, half decent at what they do. And sometimes it's a good idea to listen to that person, even if initially that gut reaction is, no, that doesn't make any sense, that's a load of rubbish. And even if, and if the way they're saying it's quite aggressive, kind of taking away the tone from the message and actually thinking about what the experience of that person is and whether or not there is some truth in that. They just can't deliver that very well, or they have to try and get an inflammatory response. So my approach when looking at social media is to have a filter where I take the kind of maybe the clickbait or the provocative title and think, well, what's the meat behind this? And is there something to it? And do I think about it that way? And so I do actually do that. And it's important to say that, because otherwise my answer would be a slightly defensive one or a slightly attacking one, which isn't helpful ultimately. So I think one of the things with our industry in particular, because we are a relatively new sport and we're learning exponentially, is that no one has all the answers. And that's really important to remember.
As someone that works in social media, I really like that approach of don't get defensive too quickly. And I always think if someone is saying something, you should first try and prove their point to yourself as well. Like, look behind it and say, actually, what are they considering which I haven't considered yet? And so why could they be right?
Yeah.
I think the immediate reaction is to go, what is the evidence to disprove what they're saying? Or how could they be wrong?
Yeah.
Whereas I'd rather just go and say, well, actually, how could they be right? Because they might not be saying something, or you haven't understood fully what they've said.
But the science is there.
Yeah.
It's like giving them the benefit of the doubt, isn't it, really?
There's a communication which is lost over social media, which
for sure
means we can jump to a defensive stance very quickly on that kind of stuff.
I do think some people are provocative purposefully, though. And I think...
marketing, isn't it?
It's marketing. A lot of it is to try and get views and comments and things, but it can be quite divisive if the people watching it don't sort of have that little filter on them, and they're married too closely to that one idea, or the idea that that person's wrong. And we've got years to basically try and get better at not doing that. And I think there is a responsibility to on people who put that content out there to think about why they need to have that response. Is the weight of what they're saying big enough to not need that? Why are they relying on that sort of extra level or layer? And is the content itself not good enough? And the more that you see people trying to create more clickbaity inflammatory responses, the more that becomes the norm. And so I would love to see that moving away, and actually people just learning without the need to try and kind of control their emotions, because that's not a good environment to learn at all.
Yeah. More entertaining.
Yeah, it is entertaining, and you know, it'll always be there, but you know, if we want to learn from that, we have to kind of think, well, what's the true message behind that? How much is this getting me emotional? Is this a good state to try and learn in? And should I really reply to this message now, or should I sit on it? And I bet you the next day you won't reply to it, because actually it's not that big a deal.
No,
is that,
yeah.
Actually, you know, a little bit of insight into my life on YouTube is my wife is, she's on maternity leave.
Yeah.
She's the marketing manager here at Lattice Training. And I get a lot of, maybe stimulating comments on our YouTube channel sometimes, often like straw man arguments where they're trying to argue against something I haven't said. And I can get a little bit wound up. I'm sure everyone has a YouTube comment or an Instagram comment at times. But best advice she always gives me is like, just don't reply today.
Yeah.
It's wait till tomorrow. Yeah.
It's quite funny watching you in the office when that happens.
Normally my emotions and my reaction is not what actually ends up on the page, which is a good thing. I have to be relatively reserved in that.
Yeah. There's this kind of angelic like face of you like having a really happy time on the thumbnail and just furious replies. Yeah. I mean just to answer your question, like unhelpful advice, particularly in the physio world, I'd say just to answer it, which is important, is that I do sometimes see diagnoses not being helpful, and also perhaps representing the fact that the person who's done the diagnosis has only done half a job. And sometimes in acute instances, like diagnoses like tenosynovitis, encapsulitis, synovitis, these sort of things, they're useful. You know, if you've tried a bit too hard on something, you've got like a really temporary flare up, and you can attribute that to whatever exercise or little bit of training block that you've done. And you could say, well, that's from that. And you've got some synovitis, and that's a straightforward kind of, you know, cause and effect. But sometimes when you're dealing with more chronic tenosynovitis and joint problems, to call those things tenosynovitis or capsulitis, synovitis, is actually just to tell someone that you've got a problem there, but not explain why it's there. You know, so it's, it becomes the what, not the why. And it's quite a lazy diagnosis in those instances. You really need to think beyond that pain and think, well, why the hell is that tendon still really annoyed? Why is that joint becoming so irritated? And if they don't look upstream and try and figure that out, it's half a diagnosis, and there's a danger in sometimes getting too comfortable with doing that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I've definitely seen as well, like, friends that have had the diagnosis of tenosynovitis and then spent months and months and months without really much improvement, and then it'll kind of go away a bit, and then they'll get back to crimping, and then all of a sudden it's back again.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's like a cause and effect thing.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, if you think.
You're putting out the fire, but there's still like fuel going into it from
someone. Exactly. So when someone says I've got capsulitis, and I'll say how long it's been there, they'll say, you know, 8 months. I just think that person's not had the right advice to figure out why it's there. And most of the people who come to me with those sort of problems, tenosynovitis, and even as bad as being told they've got arthritis in their fingers, and have had, you know, the problem for, you know, over 6 months, let's say, the majority of people with that problem will come to me for a second opinion, and I'll just look beyond the kind of immediate area, which has been often told to work harder instead of smarter and thinking about other issues. And when you figure that stuff out, you can see arthritis in quotation marks completely resolve, and that joint being way happier. So it's not a death sentence, but a lot of people have just accepted, well, that's just there, I can't do anything about it. And that's unhelpful advice, in my opinion.
I think, yeah, if you can empower someone of how they can improve out of a situation, it's, they're always going to respond better, which is partly also why when we were mentioning about the bad physio advice, often I'll kind of let it play out with my clients as well. Because I think them being told something by someone that they deem to be professional and they're happy to spend their money to visit and see, there's going to be a chance that even if I don't necessarily agree with it, it won't be, like, it could still help them out. And I think that's, so giving people power in the recovery of their rehab, I think, is a key thing. And yeah, definitely something I've appreciated when I've visited you for some of my injuries over the years.
Well, people like yourself are quite easy to work with, because, you know, you ask really good questions, and you've problem solved a lot of the stuff yourself. So whenever I get someone who's very experienced in, I'll often just spend most of the time talking to them about what they've tried, and then usually the kind of answer is in what they may have not tried, or, you know, something a little more subtle.
My take on this one was going to be doing nothing at all, or like taking complete rest. And maybe I've got a bias to exercise and strength training around injuries, because that's normally the later stage of rehab, isn't it? It's like regaining range of motion, regaining strength. And I've seen a lot of physios, normally climbing specific physios as well. But that's
interesting.
That's my box, that's my world of social media. But talking about trying to get back to movement, trying to get back to strength training as quick as possible. And generally, whenever I've seen my clients come from a generalist physio, so non-climbing specific, which doesn't necessarily understand the sport and the intensity of the sport as well, like, it's usually rest for 2 weeks, do some very light exercises, and then sign off ready to go.
Yeah.
And I think that's bad advice, because it's not bridging the gap to your sport, to your training, and to the level at which I would normally coach and want an athlete working at.
Yeah.
What's your take on that? I know rest is obviously very important in some circumstances, but I also do see some physiotherapists, PTs in America being like, the quicker you can get back to it, the better.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. It's tricky, isn't it? Because it's like this duty of care as a sort of clinician, that's physio, chiro, osteo, doctor, to not operate beyond your scope of practice. And sometimes when, you know, you get someone with a specialist sport that you just don't know anything about, it's probably more ethical to say rest than to try and step beyond your knowledge and say do this, this and this. But that's where the onus is on that person who's saying rest and they should probably follow that up with and go and see someone who knows what they're on about.
This is a very conservative approach, isn't it? It's about as conservative as you can be, because you can't go wrong with resting, but it's also not rarely going to help you progress to the point at which you get back to your sport. And we see sometimes people with pain in their finger, and they're like, oh, well, I took 2 months off, and I started again, and the pain came back exactly as it was, like nothing had changed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's the same for anything. Like, if you've got a contractile issue, like a connective tissue problem, like crimp finger, if you rest from crimp finger, that thing will be there 2 months later, like it'd never gone. And if you tried to pick a weight up, it would be even worse in terms of, you know, numbers. That's like a runner with Achilles tendinopathy who rests and is really disappointed when they do their easy park run and it's still there. So when you're talking about tendons, they obviously need to continue to be loaded. And even the most painful injured tendon, I'll always try and find a way to load that thing to stop it getting worse. But, you know, there are some instances where rest is an absolute. And, you know, something like a growth plate problem, I often, when we pick up a growth plate, I won't lead the dance with that. I'll say, go and see an orthopedic specialist. That orthopedic specialist will x-ray them, tell them they've got a growth plate problem, and tell them not to climb for 6 weeks. And that's a good hard line that that climber often needs to hear, as opposed to coming from a physio who they might not completely listen to. The white coat, the x-ray, everything else, and the same advice given from a doctor often carries a bit more gravitas. And I think as physios get better at picking up growth plate problems, you're going to see them being a little more hardlined about rest. But that is the exception rather than the rule there, Josh. You know, you're right. Keeping on moving and finding a way around that is the majority of the time what people need.
I think a lot of what we spoke about already has come to the fact that, like, getting a good diagnosis from the right person is really important, because then you get the what as well, not just the, or rather you get the why, not the what. And that really informs what you should be doing moving forwards. I see a lot of people on YouTube comments as well being like, I've got this pain, this injury, what should I do? Like, you're talking to I work with climbers and I've seen a lot of injuries, but you're definitely talking to the wrong person, and I can't really give advice over a comment. So I'd definitely tell people to go see a climbing specific physiotherapist, PT, and get that advice from them.
I think somebody who has an idea of the demands of the sport is going to help way more than someone doesn't. And I think the great thing about these, especially like since pandemic, a lot of physios now offer like Zoom consultations and things, so it doesn't matter if you're not like in a area of the country that has a really good climbing specific physio, and you can get in touch with these people across the internet.
Even if that's your second opinion, you say you're generous and you take that diagnosis to someone else and say, this is what they've said, what do you think I should be doing to get back? Because the level matters. If you've just started climbing, maybe see a generalist, and that what they're thinking of is like, oh, I've climbed a couple of times, I know what that means, it's you going up the wall on these big holds and swinging around. But if it's someone like Aidan Roberts and they're like, I've got some finger pain, your approach to rehabbing that's probably gonna be very different, because you understand what the demands are for that athlete.
Just saying a bit more on what you said there, Johnny, the remote work, it really has picked up massively. And I mean, a lot of my work's done with people in America, and it is amazing how much you can do on a remote call. When I do them, a lot of it's sort of weighing up that person, listening to them and thinking, well, how accurate are they? How specific are they? Are they body aware? And then I start doing sort of batch testing, and you can see quite quickly in how they move and test and the feedback you give them, they give you on how successful that session's going to be. And it's amazing what you can figure out. I mean, I've modified tests now, through remote work, and it's actually improved how I work in clinic as well. And so, it has changed the way I work in ways I didn't imagine it would. It's been really interesting.
My next question is, other than finger injuries, because obviously this is where the conversation has gone for climbers, but other than finger injuries, what are the most common injuries you're seeing in climbers?
I see with shoulder injuries, I do see quite a lot of labral type problems. So you know, not the rotator cuff itself, but the actual cartilage within the socket, the ball and socket of the shoulder. It's quite easy to blame the rotator cuff because obviously when you're rotating your arm, you're going to feel pain from within that joint. And that's quite a common one to see getting chronic because the rotator cuff rehab approach hasn't worked. So that's actually one of the most sort of common chronic oversights I see in people with shoulder pain, is that it's actually coming from the labrum itself, which is actually connected to the shoulder blade and not the ball spinning in the socket, but much more the interaction between the ball spinning in the socket with the shoulder blade rotating as well.
Hmm. What's the approach to, and well, how would you diagnose the difference other than the fact you might be working on rotator cuff and you're not seeing it improve? That's an indication, is it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the position of your arm really changes how that labrum's loaded through space and time. And a really good example of how a rotator cuff test might be misdiagnosed is, I'll give you an example. If you're standing or lying and your elbow's behind you, the humeral head is moving forwards. That moves forwards in the actual glenoid. And that front loads the labrum. And if you've got a labral issue and your elbow's behind you and you're testing your internal rotation, that will give you pain quite early on because the ball is squashing the labrum. And you usually find, let's say, you do it and you get pain at 5 kilos. It's very common, if the rotator cuff is okay and the labrum isn't, for you to take that elbow and keep it into neutral or slightly forwards, retest and see the pain disappearing and the number going up to like 15 to 20 kilos. So if you're doing like a test and you're thinking, well, this is a rotator cuff problem and the elbow is not positioned right and you pull, it would be very easy to go down the route of this being a rotator cuff problem and doing lots of rotator cuff movements. And if you think about why that's not a great idea, if the rotator cuff is actually fine, is you're making a ball spin in the socket repeatedly for high volume, and that's not going to help. If you think about a cartilage problem in the knee, a meniscus problem, for instance, you're not going to give someone an exercise where they wiggle their lower leg around. That's only going to annoy it. And sometimes rotator cuff approaches annoy labrums for that reason. So really what you've really got to think about is the coordination between your shoulder blade and the arm. And again, on our team trainings, what we've done is we've looked at things like a pull-up. And if you've got a bad labral problem, you'll often see a thrutchy, weird, uncoordinated movement on the side that has the problem. And that's that person intuitively readjusting the position of the cup so that that labrum doesn't get pinched to allow other muscles to fire. It's amazing how intuitively climbers do that. But that's, for me, one of the a really good sign that there's something beyond the cuff going on there.
Yeah, very similar to when I approached.
Yeah, exactly.
The first time, and I remember it was actually for like shoulder abduction, and then my trap was firing to like do the final bit of the movement. So it was kind of like you had the first part, and then it would stop, and then my trap would get involved to do like the second part.
You're
still
compensating.
Yeah, it is amazing what the bodies can work around.
Especially climbers, you know, they're the best at hiding a problem. They're the best at intuitively moving around something because they can. You know, you can just move your foot a little bit. If you're a baseball pitcher, you're pretty much going to pitch that ball the same way. If you're a fast bowler, you have to pitch, you know, throw it the same way. You can't really work through it, but a climber can. You know, learning to spot these things is really important and very satisfying when you figure it out.
Mm. Those baseball pitches as well, it's mental. Like, have you seen any of like the slow-mo picture or thing where it looks like their arms external are basically rotation. Not attached to their body, basically?
Ah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, they do like 90 degrees external rotation, don't they?
Yeah, so they've got like a compensated shoulder, a bit like tennis players. Tennis players will have the same thing. You know, you can't use normal girds, you know, GIRD, so you're looking at kind of normal range of motion testing. They don't apply to people like that. And if you try and improve the movement they're bad in, the movement that they need the arm to be good in will get worse.
That's interesting. Something I've kind of seen, but I'm not sure if it's fully a pattern yet because I've not seen enough people with it. But do you generally see if people are good in external rotation of the shoulder, they've got a poorer range internally? Do you see that kind of shift together? So internal brings external along with it?
Sometimes. So you can get something called a tight posterior capsule. And that just means that the muscles at the back of the shoulder are a little bit
reluctant to pay out, and you've got excessive tension there. Those sort of things you can change quite well. But if you're talking about deeper than that, into the actual, you know, intrinsic issues in the joint, the shape of the joint, that sort of thing, that there will be a kind of a bottoming out. A good example of that would be someone like a hip problem with dysplasia. They'll have lots of internal rotation, but the morphology of their ball and socket means they just can't rotate their knee out. You know, they're going to struggle to actually get that excessive external rotation. And for those guys, you have to just, you know, explain that's the case, just so that they can accept that and work around those things.
Yeah. I could probably dive into rotation of the shoulder for another hour, but I'm going to move on.
Why is that?
I love it.
Well, I've got one more question, I reckon, about the difference of indoors and outdoor climbers. Because I would hypothesize that shoulder injuries are way more prevalent in comp climbers these days, with the way that the climbing movement has gone in comps, especially where it's no more small holds and more like flinging yourself and then really quickly decelerating, controlling a weird position that ultimately your shoulders are going to take the brunt of.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting to hear if that is what you've also seen, Paul.
So the majority of indoor issues I see in beginners, at least, not comp climbers, is things where they're just not landing very well. So, you know, ankles, knees, elbows even, because they're dislocating their elbows and they fall out on an outstretched hand. And it's quite a weird sport in that sense. You know, you do your waiver and then you just assume that person knows how to land from, you know, 10 foot when they've never landed in their life. So the traumatic stuff I see mainly around landing issues. But yeah, the kind of for more experienced climbers, like comp climbers and things, shoulders are definitely one of the issues. And like, you know, your problem that you had, Johnny, I usually first come to me is because their neck's not right. And that's because all those muscles around the scap have learned to fire in a way that doesn't really help their shoulder, but and creates neck problems as the scap tries to move into a better place so the ball can spin without pain. It's really common to see labral tears developing into neck problems, developing into nerve problems, and that thing being cyclical. And some pretty good coaches I've worked with recently have had like chronic problems, all three of those things. And we've just unpicked them slowly by working on that shoulder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you asked why I'd be interested in the shoulder and you kind of touched on it there, Jennifer. I'm a flexibility coach. So I do a lot. I work with a lot of people, but probably 80% of the clients I work with, like we really go to town on the hips, lower body, and for most people, I'll see like average or okay, maybe even poor range of motion in the shoulder. But I generally avoid going to town on that, like I will on the hips, partly because it's a time thing, and I don't want to overload the client with work to do. But also, there's kind of like how much range you need in the shoulder for certain things, particularly people that are boulders and are spending a lot of time in an overhang where your shoulder's rarely going into a lot of external rotation. Yeah. Maybe a lot of internal rotation if you're, you know, like Fontainebleau kind of top out. Mm-hmm. But also like the balance between strength, range of motion, this level of like internal rotation, external rotation. I just think it's a really interesting topic, which I've not fully explored yet within climbers. Mm. Because generally it's not great. Like we see lots of really good climbers with pretty poor external rotation of the shoulder and really kind of getting away with
it.
But then, yeah, it's not like a pattern I've seen. But also I'm not 100% sure whether that's just partly like it's the cause and effect thing. Have climbers neglected the aspect that we need more shoulder range of motion and flexibility to improve performance? And because it's not seen as an important aspect in the climbing community, therefore no one really does it. But are we going to eventually think, like, actually, I know with competition climbers, it's now almost a necessity. So if you were to test a group of climbers, are you looking at how they perceive the need for flexibility, therefore train it, therefore have it more for their sport? Mm. I don't know. I'm going to try and not go too far down this tangent.
Yeah, I think it...
Yeah, it's funny. It's like a prerequisite in the comps, though, doesn't it, now? It's like, yeah. If you don't have that, you've not really got a problem.
Yeah. Because I think if you took a climber from the 70s and 80s, or like a group of climbers, and you looked at lower body flexibility, I assume it would be a lot worse than a group today, where flexibility is now more recognised or accepted as an important aspect within climbing performance. And I wonder if it's not that climbing has more requirements of flexibility. The outdoor rock climbing is the same, but I kind of, as we understand it more, we sort of unpick it, and I think finger strength is getting higher because people, it's the culture, isn't it? Like, we now just hang on a fingerboard as much as we can.
Yeah, people do love fingerboard.
Yeah.
People do love things.
I think in our sport, people almost have to get to the point where we're all doing too much of it to realise that was probably more to do. that's an interesting thing to think about. I think, you know, the route setters obviously have got really good at finding positions where the human body finds it difficult to generate forces. And if you think about it, in a way, route setters are masters of understanding body movement, without perhaps being able to articulate it in a faffy kind of, you know, Latin way with anatomy. But they really know where, you know, a combined movement of, let's say, a deep hip squat with like lots of thoracic rotation and external rotation of the shoulder, and then turning the hand around so you've got your shoulder and external rotation, you've got your hand fully pronated. You know, the muscles aren't designed to be strong in those positions. And like Johnny says, it's the sport, it's the competition climbing where those things are needed more. And that's because route setters are basically not letting climbers get away with having weaknesses or stiffnesses and things. So it's a really interesting thing to see, the route setting. And to some extent, comp climbing, you know, the comp climbers, they're always going to be at the mercy of route setters. Route setters are really important in terms of, you know, channeling where this sport goes and how it looks.
Mm. I used to love setting local comps for that.
Because you were being really devious. You're like, ha.
Yeah. It's like, right, what do they not want to do today? And it's like, they wouldn't normally do it at, like, any other time that they come in the gym, because they'll just avoid it and try something else. But this is a comp and they've got to give it a go.
I think this is why, I can't remember what climbing film I was watching, but it was an old indoor climbing film. I had like, oh, it was a competition with Dave Graham, Chris Sharma. I think it was performed in America. I was watching the indoor style of like climbing. It was probably in like the mid-90s or something.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just like basic board climbing kind of, you know. Yeah. There was some stuff that required flexibility. But now if you watch it, like...
A little bit of a dyno here.
Clearly what the setters have done, if they said like, well, climbers just have really good finger strength now. And they can just do like, you know, campus moves on a hard wall.
Yeah.
So we need to make it more and more challenging. So they now make sure that if you want to do a competition boulder, you need to like jump into some sort of like double palm press with your shoulders like you know, extended behind you.
Yeah.
So now you require, like, you need this kind of shoulder flexibility, or you need to do a slab where you can basically do a side split.
Yeah.
And like that wasn't required from climbers before. And maybe there was stuff like that outside, but if you didn't have the flexibility, you just wouldn't do that boulder.
You'd go find another bit of rock.
You'd move on to the next
thing. Yeah. I think my job would be a lot more boring if we were still back in the days of like Salavat Ratmatov crimping, his little Casio watch and things. My job would be a lot more boring. It's a lot more interesting because the setting's always slightly ahead of the training in some ways, because okay, they're trained at that now, and now what should we do? Let's put a dual tex upside down and make them skate along it with their feet like they're, you know, inline skateboarders on a wax curve, you know. Like, it'll always change, and for that reason my job's always interesting. That no tex dyno stuff was very interesting.
I was handling that for years, because like, I remember like looking about it and being like, everyone's skin is trashed in comps, and it was like, surely the only way forward from this is you remove texture, make holds positive, and then that way skin doesn't become the limiting factor. And then it happened.
That was a good example of setters going as far as they could and making something really crazy. It was like a cat amongst the pigeons, but on a lower scale, that is what happens, you know, year on year in comps. It'll always be evolving. Holds companies will make things new, and you know, when the crack came in, everyone was like, wow, there's a crack in climbing, and now everyone's good at crack climbing in comps. And
are you going to have to predict the next kind of injuries then, like from crack climbing? You're going to see more wrist injuries or more like
more elbow problems,
injuries in the metacarpals or something.
It'll be from our Christmas social. That's the next level of comp climbing. We added a load of resistance bands to climbs, which made it a bit more entertaining.
External assistance. No, please don't do
that. Crack climbing's actually one of the main things is obviously you're rotating your thumb down, and I look after quite a lot of big wall climbers. That's where the America work comes in. And you know, when your thumb's turned fully down, you get quite a lot of elbow problems, particularly in the joint, the outside joint, your radiocapitellar joint. There's a lot more pressure on that outside bit of your elbow when your thumb's turned down. So it does get quite a lot of crack climbers, that sort of movement.
Are you going to have a high prevalence of lateral epicondylitis? Because I guess the muscle is lengthened in that state and probably also under a lot of pressure as well.
Yeah. I mean, you're less extensor loaded there. You're much more kind of anchored through the hand. And the emphasis is a lot on the rotators. So if you did get a contractile problem from that outside bit of your elbow, it would be more likely coming from something like the supinator muscle groups, which are attached to essentially the same place. So you'd still be under the banner of lateral epicondylosis or whatever. But yeah, it'll be more because your thumb's fully turned down and that outside supinator is fully lengthened. So yeah, actually, you're completely right, Josh, what you just said.
Yeah, just for a different reason.
Yeah. Well done, Josh.
Yeah. I'll take it.
YouTube star, coach.
Mic drop.
Some of my favourite social media is following Huffy's Instagram account, so we can guess the injury. I love that.
Oh, yeah.
Those quizzes are great.
That's cool. Yeah, I'd like to put more time into that stuff. I'm like the least active person of the sort of physios on Instagram, but that's because I've spent quite a long time just trying to get balance in my life, I suppose. I'd like to do a bit more in this year. I've taken a day off work in my clinic here at BWT. That's the way I work normally. I've got a lot of ideas for that stuff, so I'm quite looking forward to it. But yeah, generally that gets pretty well received. And I'm amazed at how good people are at getting those problems. And also the clinical reasoning, how people reason it and what they do next. And like you say, Josh, is probably a better sort of reasoning than most, you know, generalized physios in that respect, because they know the sport so well.
Yeah. That caveat to that is stay in your lane.
Yeah, this is when you've just got a bunch of climbing physios answering your questions.
Actually, I often assume their climbers are doctors, but they're not. They're just climbers. Like, oh, you're better than all the doctors and climbing physios trying to answer this.
Well, they got that one right. Yeah. I've got Johnny wanted to ask a question.
Oh yeah, yeah. Speaking of, we chatted about duty of care a bit earlier on, and I've heard this story about you in the past that I knew you used to be into your grappling.
Oh yeah,
And I heard of this rumor that you basically stopped because you broke someone pretty badly, but they were a nice enough guy to help them out through the rehab.
And oh yeah,
is this a true story?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's completely true. That's that's kind of ironic. That
what happened?
Yeah, that was probably one of the later competitions that I did. It's fun.
What were you competing?
It was Nogi Jiu-Jitsu. So just for a bit of context, from the age of 16, I've basically done. I got my black belt at the age of 16, and then I started doing grappling and even things like Filipino martial arts. I was just really into all of that stuff. And then in Sheffield, I started training with a group of people called the Sheffield Shoe Fighters. And that was like strongmen essentially pushing cars and hitting tires with sledgehammers. And there was a ring where you grappled. And they had really good fighters there. And they went to London and to London Shoe Fighters, which aren't affiliated with Sheffield Shoe Fighters. And that they were a level above again. And I just got really into it. And I was lucky enough to roll with, you know, the best people out there, and I got all right at it. My grip really helped me out actually from climbing, and I just got more and more into it. And I went through the kind of beginners categories, the intermediate, and then into advanced, which is kind of looking at purple belt to black belt. And I was grappling with a lot of these guys, and when you put a ligament on in a tight position, there's very little feedback from that ligament. And to escape from a lot of these holds, you have to do quite big movements. I was grappling with someone. Unfortunately, I'd been doing it for about 15 years. And, you know, my wife often see me coming back banged up with like cauliflower ear. I used to syringe my own ears and bandage it up and stuff like that. And she just sort of went, oh, it's just something he does. But as I got better at the competitions, I started winning more. I sort of started thinking, well, maybe you could come and watch one, you know, because you're not going to want to come and watch one where I get beaten up. And it was the worst competition ever for her to come and watch, because
The first person, I got in a head and arm triangle. So basically, it was like a karate choke. And the referees were really bad in that event. It was a nationals, advanced nationals. And I choked that guy unconscious, even though that shouldn't happen. You know, like, it should come to the point where he's about to pass out, you know, looking at his hand or doing something to make sure that, you know, it stopped fairly quickly after the blood choke. And this guy didn't do it. And I heard this poor guy gurgling away and I was shouting at the referee, it's over, he's out. I let go in the end and the poor guy started convulsing. And I just, the first thing I did was look up at my wife, who looked horrified. She was up in the crowd, just looking absolutely horrified with her hand over her mouth. And then I won another round. And then the final, it was just, I put a key lock on someone, which is where you basically take them into, ironically, full external rotation. And he just wouldn't submit. And, I was shouting at the ref saying it's tight. I was saying to him, try and just submit. It's over. And my coach was shouting, you know, take it, which is, you know, which is what you should do with a submission. And I didn't put it on much more. He tried to buck and escape and he actually broke his own arm when that happened.
He broke his arm, so it wasn't the shoulder.
Wow. It was his elbow.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And it was a horrible experience. And the worst thing about it was, you know, it was televised. And when I watched it back, I saw my opponent with his arm, broken arm, held across his body, and he was clapping for me with his good arm against the side of his leg. And when I saw that, it just broke me. And I thought, right, I'm never doing that again. It doesn't matter if you're good at it. It's just not worth it. So I couldn't actually do that again. So I found that guy online and, yeah, I helped him out and he got back to full health. He's actually a really good grappler now. And that was kind of my penance. And I thought, well, that's that. I'm putting that to bed. My poor wife, she it was a horrendous experience for her.
Yeah.
I was going to say.
Impression of, it's like, can you do that to everyone or not?
We've been doing that for 15 years.
Yeah, is this how you're such a good video? You've broken all these people.
It wasn't good. I don't say it with any ego at all. It's not a false modesty. It was just a horrible experience. And it was like a moment where you realise that's it for that thing. It's never going to do that again.
Oh, wow. I mean, it sounds like there was quite a lot of ego on the mat that day. People not tapping.
Well, that if you're a black belt, you won't tap.
That's where you're going wrong.
You'll take it as close as you can to a submission. You'll see people tapping more these days because the game's changed a lot of the time now. It's rolling for ankle locks. I mean, Josh, you grapple, don't you?
Yeah, I've been doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu for about a year, but mainly gi, where the grip definitely helps. Yeah. I frustrate a lot of people because I just hold on,
human blanket.
You know, I got 5 minutes. Yeah, I was going to say, I guess I've not done competitions and I probably won't because I don't want to get injured. Climbing's still my sport. Yeah. This is my side hustle, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, generally, I think that when you're in competition, there's a lot of adrenaline, isn't there? And if you're in a final, you probably don't want to tap. You're going to do everything to try and get out.
Yeah, a lot of people train those end ranges so that they can be really flexible. Like my shoulders, even now, if I put my hand behind my back, I can still basically pull my elbow all the way forwards, which is basically, you know, defense against the Kimura. These sort of things. I just keep that mobility now because I think it's pretty good for my joints and make sure I'm strong through that range. And
I remember you doing that one of our training days and basically all of us getting nowhere near.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, like even my, you know, hip flexibility, it's just all there from my rubber guard and it's just natural to keep that now. So I guess it's definitely taught me some good things and you definitely get strong in ways you don't when you climb, which is, you know, actually really good for climbers, as you know all too well.
Yeah, that's actually brings up a question that I just thought of. Have you come across any other sports where you feel like you've helped someone out and you've been like, they've got something really good that might transfer well into climbing performance?
That's a good question. What other sports do I work with? I think
I've definitely seen that in jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
That like being flexible and having a strong grip paid off massively straight away.
There's always going to be these little hacks that someone just does something and then that no one else can keep up with them because they're so more developed.
I don't know if you found this, Huffy, but when I went to my class in Sheffield, my gym, I'm like, I weigh 73 kilos. And they split the class to sub 75. It was me, all the women, and the teenagers.
Oh, yeah.
And then all the other guys were like, 80 plus. So I'm tall, but like, for, you know, but I'm tiny compared to a lot of the people that I grapple with.
Yeah.
And I even then, I think I was frustrating people, like, who is this little white belt, like, just who's not letting go, and like, how has he got his leg there, sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely.
That transfers super well between the two, I think.
I think it's a good group to be in. I mean, I do still grapple occasionally, and the most dangerous person is the big white belt with an ego. They'll break you because you're always going to try and help them, and they're going to want to not let you win. If I weigh 77 kilos now, and you know, I'll grapple with someone maybe 100, 110 kilos, there's no way that guy, even especially as a white belt, because he won't appreciate how jiu-jitsu works, there's no way he's going to want this little guy to submit them. So they'll do everything they can to try and not let that happen. And that's where they're a little clumsy with their weight, and they'll kind of make your knee go in a funny angle. They'll sit on it or something, and you'll let that happen to some extent because you're trying to guide them in through these positions. So I think it's good that wherever you're training, they separate you out by the weight. That's actually really important in a lot of cases.
It only happens when I have one of our coaches, which is she's like probably in the 60 kilo range most of the time. I'm just, you know, open, which I prefer to do actually. I don't want to just like fight teenagers. But yeah, that happened to me. That happened to me about 6 months in. Do you know Fat Man Roll? If you're in Turtle, you get an arm over. They basically tucked my hand under and you just roll. And I went flying over this guy. He's probably 110 kilos. Just shoulder straight into the floor. That had me out for about 4 weeks.
Yeah.
It was a bit annoying.
Yeah, you got to watch that. Wrestling's the worst for that. I mean, you won't do much wrestling with the gi jiu-jitsu, but wrestling was the worst. It was so unpredictable. I learned a lot about managing rib injuries through wrestling because there's so much rotational torque really quickly. A lot of wrestlers have got rib instabilities, and I've actually learned loads, not through the performance side, which is what your question was, Johnny, but the injury side, working with wrestlers, and I'll see people with complex rib injuries, and the stuff I've learned through that and my own injuries, because I used to wrestle a lot as well.
All right, so you are black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, no gi.
Well, the irony is that I've basically done one gi competition. Was the FILA Nationals, and I basically won that. That was a white belt one, and I got given my blue belt when I started submitting purple belts and brown belts in the gym. I've grappled and beat black belts, but there's no way in hell now I could go into any competition. Even if I went in against a good blue belt, I'd get submitted a lot. So yeah, I'm a bit out of practice with competitions.
Like you said, it seems to change a lot. I actually one thing I thought about with jiu-jitsu is climbing gets called a technical sport a lot. And it's like, sport. Oh, Dick, don't put too much emphasis on strength training. It's a technical sport. But then when I started jiu-jitsu, I was like, it's a bit like climbing in the sense you've got to find your sequence.
It's exactly like climbing. That's
the
a good.
It's constantly moving. Yeah. So you're like, whatever your next move was going to be is changing. So it's like, it's a dynamic climbing. It's so much more technical, I thought. So much more tactical. Yeah. And I just think, like, if climbers had tried some other sports, they would realize that climbing's actually not that, and not as technical, and that excuse that is.
Yeah, I don't think our job would really exist if climbing was as technical as people make it seem.
That's really interesting because, you know, when I was doing grappling, I was so obsessed. I'd basically write down flow charts. I'd write down, right, so I'm in half guard, this guy does that, then I do this, then I've got three options. If I take this, he does this. And it got, these things got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I would just look at it and I'd review it and remind myself and play it over in my head.
And then when I went climbing, I was like, this is incredible. This is like an opponent who just lies there and does nothing.
I felt the same with like tennis. You'd have like, all right, if I hit this serve into this direction, the ball's coming back at this point. You're then the next shot's this. This will come to that. And like, yeah, so many things that could change within that plan, but you have that plan.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, climbing is like, I have this plan and it's going to stay as that plan unless I like mess up horribly on the move.
And I'll come back tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly.
It's true. Yeah. What you just said there is exactly right. It's when you compare it to grappling, it's on a plate for you, isn't it?
Yeah. It doesn't seem that technical or that tactical after trying.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Okay, I wanted to jump into this question, which we touched on earlier, which is, what are your lessons from being a physio to our GB climbing star, Shauna Coxey?
Oh, yeah. Well, that...
this is a big event, obviously. First time at the Olympics, I imagine?
Yeah, that wasn't my first time at the Olympics, but my first time working at the Olympics. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'd done a bit of volunteering in other sort of Olympic style sort of environments, but not actually being the medical lead, which is what I am for GB climbing. So it's definitely an honor to have this job. It's a privilege. It on a personal level, it's very fulfilling. It gives you experiences that, or it gives you access to the climbing community that most people don't see. You know, you'll see the kind of competition side of things when the lights are on, but actually when you're in isolation, you know, in hotel rooms and everything else with these guys, you realize there's a totally different side to competition climbing. And the climbers are lovely with each other. There's they're like a family, brothers and sisters, playful, that sort of thing. And for me, I think it was Cran, the first one I went to. And if anyone's been to Cran climber, if the professional climbers, and you know, if there's any medical people from the climbing world listening, they'll know the isolation there is tiny. It's like a little teepee, old school bouldering wall. And my first ever experience with Shauna was on that competition. And I was just sat there with everyone in climbing, just literally on top of each other. And within 5 minutes, I was like trying boulders that, you know, Jan Hoyer and Magos had been trying. And it was like, wow, this is such an intense environment. And Shauna had kind of prepped me for that. And she said, you know, get ready. It's going to be pretty intense. And it was, but in a really good way, like almost instantly I felt kind of at home in that environment. And the medical team were even more like a family, I suppose. Our ethos is basically injury isn't competition, and we all help each other out. So, you know, I'll be imaging people from different countries. I'll happily do that, and we share equipment, and we kind of, you know, ask to borrow bits and pieces, and it's incredible. You know, on a personal level, it's a really nice environment to be. But
that's really nice to hear.
Yeah, when you think of something at such a high competitive level, you kind of think it's going to be very secretive, and maybe it is in some sports, you know, like
definitely.
Well, the coaches is different.
Okay,
so it is chess between the coaches, and again they get on after the competition, but it's game face for the coaches, whereas physios, even in the higher competition, that's actually where we, if we work collectively, we're even more used to each other, more helpful. Whereas with the coaches, they really, it's just, it's war then.
Yeah. To be fair, I used to have that mindset coming from tennis. I used to like not really like seeing potential opponents knowing how I trained other than the people that I like trained with on day to day. Because it was like, right, how can I get an upper hand? I don't want to see them or them to see me working as hard as I am or something like that.
But on a professional level, like it's a different story. So, it's quite a high pressure job to have. And when the Tokyo Games was on, you suddenly realize that the world is watching and you've done all this extra medical training and you think, well, if things don't go right, then it's literally going to be me on the mats with the world watching, trying to manage this problem. And every sort of, you know, medical lead, physio, doctor has that kind of pressure on their shoulders. And then you sort of realize, well, you really need to know what you're doing, on a kind of clinical skills level. And then more generally, my job is to basically block out all the kind of, you know, lights and cameras, because they're not there for me at all. You know, that's got nothing to do with me.
My job is basically to know my team and know my athlete even better, and no matter what, advocate for the athlete and put them first. That's a common saying in sport, you know, athlete first approach, but it isn't always the case that it is athlete first, because you've got, you know, a good athlete's going to have a national governing body, sponsors, expectations, friends, family, public, and there's a push and pull there with the athlete in the middle. And so at any one time, you can make a decision that's going to hurt one part of that triangle or two. And I've fallen out with, you know, managers because I've made decisions that isn't perhaps what not good optics for the competition side of things, because that athlete would be great if that athlete would attend that competition, but it's not in their best interests. Sponsors, so they want someone to go and do something. It's not great because they're, you know, working through an injury. Again, that hurts the sponsor, perhaps even hurts the athlete, you know, financially, or just pulling the athlete out of a competition when they really want to go and saying, well, I'm thinking about you, not for the Olympics, but I'm thinking about you beyond this, you know, when you, in 10 years' time. Yeah. So you can't be a yes man, and you can't be everyone's friend. And that's perhaps an unexpected answer, but...
Was that something that was difficult with Shauna when her meniscus went, like, in the qualies or whatever it was, or in the practice?
Yeah, that was tough. I mean, I can't put into words how tough Shauna is mentally. No one will have any idea, like, how hard she grafted in the last few years to get onto the mats there. And when her meniscus went, you know, 3 days before the competition, I couldn't believe it. She first sort of told me her knee didn't feel right when we were walking through the athlete village, and it looked like a tight muscle at that point. So we put a little heel wedge into her shoe just to keep her out of that extension. But, you know, that got more and more obvious, more painful, more unstable. Couldn't do stairs without the knee giving way. We could unlock that knee to get it moving, and we would unlock it, and then she'd get going, and then it would lock or give way again. And that's a good example, Johnny, because, you know, we had speed at the first event, and you can't imagine a worse event for a meniscus than speed climbing. And Shauna just, you know, I said to her, we had a chat, and I said, you know, if I can't unlock that knee, if you call a medical timeout, we can't unlock it and it's too painful to stand on, we're going to have to call this. And it was a little moment. It didn't last very long. And I could just tell by her face that wasn't going to happen. And, you know, she went out on speed with this knee that most people would be on crutches with. And she ran her speed. She did really well in the bouldering. She just went out there, blocked it all out. And yeah, the whole time I'm just thinking, please don't lock. Please don't lock. But if it wasn't Shauna being Shauna, you know, I may well have been called onto the mats and it might have looked different, but she's just so damn tough. Yeah, it's very, very impressive how she got onto the mats in the Olympics. Very, very impressive.
Yeah. It sounds like you had to juggle a lot. Was this your first time working with such a large team of supporting roles for one athlete then?
Yeah, probably. I mean, people came and went over the course of getting to the games. So once you got selected, we had various people in and out. And, you know, some people just didn't last in that environment because for one reason or another. A lot of the time it's expectations. And, you know, Shauna's got really high expectations. You know, you've got to be ready to be challenged regularly on what you're saying. And if what you're saying is useful and makes sense, then, you know, it will be listened to and it will be carried through. But if there's any gray in that, you'll get challenged on that. And you have to be really sure about that, what you're saying is the right thing at that moment in time. And that pressure is quite a lot for some people to take. And, you know, you've got to grow thick skin. I've grew really thick skin. I dropped all my ego and it was one of the best things in terms of my career, operating at a high level, the games in that respect. And yeah, it was an invaluable experience, really.
Nice. You've got to go soon. Do you have time for one more question? Okay. So this is a big one, but I did want to ask this because I think it's always nice to get perspective on training, which is obviously what we're most interested about. We talk a lot about injury, but yeah, when it comes to training or training culture, what would be one thing that you would try to influence or change from the current situation?
Oh, we've talked a little bit, haven't we, about social media and rhetoric and things like that. I would like the kind of culture of social media training to change. I'd like it to be less inflammatory. I'd like it to be less binary and dogmatic. Don't do this, do that. You know, I don't. We know anyone who knows anything about climbing, it, when they see a post of this versus this, knows it's way more nuanced than that.
Yeah.
And I would like that to maybe just quieten down a little bit. Around specifics, things that I'd like to see, I'd like some more emphasis on spinal mobility. I think that's really important. There's a lot of mention about hips and rotation, but hip extension is one of the main reasons that, you know, especially in sport, in competition climbing, if you look at how anyone generates momentum, they're going to booty thrust right close to the wall and get into lots of hip extension to then generate their force. But I don't see much at all on mobility into hip extension. I see a lot about external rotation, internal rotation, twisting, but not much on hip extension. And
I think even just for high stepping, you always focus on the lifting leg, the hip
exactly.
flexion. But if you can't go into hip extension, and if you have tight lats, it's going to affect how your hip extension
goes,
because it's just going to pull you into like an anterior pelvic tilt, and then the hip extension is going to be,
you just look like a triangle on the wall, basically.
I think that's it, Josh.
I think a lot of the stuff on mobility comes in how to get into positions, but not necessarily how to get out of it. And that generating of momentum to get out of that position and generate force is actually, you know, the opposite of all that stuff. You don't want to be really rotated. You don't want high knees. You want to have a good amount of hip extension and, you know, really use all the horsepower through your legs, which don't generate as much horsepower if you're really twisted. So, yeah, I think hip mobility is key, not just in terms of mobility, but the strength, so you can use those muscles when you're there. And that would come from closed chain things like picking off the floor, deadlifting, that sort of thing, where you're putting more force through that person's body than their body weight, which again, climbers don't tend to do. The combination of those two things is very powerful, and you'll see a lot of good comp climbers, you know, doing those two things. And perhaps not so much in the general population, because you won't see anything about it on social media. Spinal mobility, thoracic extension, that's another important one. And you'll know already, when you lift your arm up, last 10 degrees or last bit of your arm coming up will come from the middle of your back opening up. If you're doing lots of core work and things like that, you're not really going to be able to open up that thoracic spine so much, because all your obliques and intercostal muscles, they're all going to be pulling you down into that position. So you could have a tight lat, but if your thoracic spine doesn't extend because your trunk is generally pretty fixed, then you can stretch your lat all you want. Your arm's never going to go higher. So movements I quite like a modified cobra pose, where you basically go into a cobra pose, bend one knee up and rotate so that your sternum points in the same direction as that knee. What that'll do is it'll drag behind everything on the opposite side where your leg's straight. And when you breathe in and out, you'll feel an incredible amount of force going through from your pelvis to all the ribs. And essentially, if you can open that area up on both sides, you'll get a lot more freedom of movement through your thoracic spine, then your foundation for your shoulders better, and the whole thing starts working better. So that's a great stretch for the right people.
I'll give my favorite exercise for that. You've done the dumbbell lat pullover, but you modify it so you go perpendicular to the bench.
Yes.
So you can take the weight past the bench, but you can also drop the hips on the other side. So you get into thoracic extension, and then you let the weight take your lats into a stretch as well.
So you're in a kind of bridge, almost bridge position with your spine.
Like a back bridge.
That's a good one.
Maybe my 2024 goal will be do a back bridge. For me,
you're not back bridge.
I'm surprised at that.
I
thought you'd be good at that.
It's very ugly. My lats are too tight. I think I'm a bit lazy with, I train flexibility quite a lot, or at least I have. I'm a bit lazy with only training the bits I think I need. But I think a lot of people do that.
It's time, isn't it?
Because you just focus on what you can, can't you, rather than do a bit.
Do you know one of my 2024 goals? Is to basically complete Kai Harada's warm-up. You know Kai Harada, the Japanese bouldering.
Okay, where can we find that?
You'll probably see it somewhere online. It may be, you know, if he's got a YouTube channel. That's, again, another beauty is you get to see how everyone warms up. And he was such a beautiful mover when he's basically warming up. He flows from a back bridge into other positions just incredibly well. Beautiful mobility and strength through all those ranges, and no real point in the chain being sort of restricted or compensated for. And a lot of the Japanese team have got that kind of beautiful fluid movement in the kind of extension. And it's not a surprise that, you know, they're brilliant at springing out of those positions. So his warm up is a thing to see, and let's do it. If you can't do a back bridge, I'll work on Kai Harada's warm up, and we can maybe have a back bridge off in 6 months' time. As long as you don't get injured in a BJJ comp before that.
I'll take it easy. I've only just gone back after taking a break because, you know, looking after our newborn. And I've been taking it very easy because I've not been getting much sleep and I'm like a bit cautious.
Yeah, that's understandable. That's probably a good idea.
Okay, well, I'm heading down to Paul in the summer, so we'll meet up and we'll...
Oh, yeah, it'd be good to cover a role.
Yeah. Cool. All right, nice. Thanks.
That won't happen.
Cool. Okay. We'll let you go.
Nice one.
Thank you for joining us.
It's been fun. I feel like I could do a lot more. We could talk a lot more, but maybe do it again sometime.
Yeah, I mean, we skipped a few questions, so maybe we'll leave it a bit and then we'll get you back on. We'll do another one. We'll talk more.
Sounds good. Yeah. Nice one, guys.
Cool. All right. Cheers. Thank you very much.
Take it easy. Bye now. Yeah.